Now we're going to go with our interview with Lisa McGurr from Harvard University. Welcome, Professor McGurr.
Thank you very much.
Why did you write this book called Suburban Warriors about the formation of the new right in Orange County in the 60s? Why pick this topic?
For a couple of reasons. I just started out as a PhD dissertation at Columbia University, and at that time, you sort of have to look around for topics. I was doing social history and studying kind of social history of politics in the 20th century, and it became pretty clear to me. It was also at a time where conservatives were gaining a lot of power on the national level, post Reagan's election and after a number of kind of conservative gains nationally. And I just started thinking that, you know, there wasn't anything really historically grounded to understand the success of conservatives at the national level, the roots of that conservatism, where it came from, what its popular base was. And as I started to look at it, I realized the significance was to look at the grassroots level, to look at the kind of popular base of conservatism. That's what was most neglected in studies on the post-war American right. And also studies on the 1960s, there was very little on conservatism. Studies in the 1960s focus on civil rights, on student protests, on the counterculture, not on grassroots conservatives. And that's what I sought to fill a gap there.
Because the notion of the 60s is always kind of left-wing turmoil, you know, and social change. People don't think of it as a right-wing or right, right politics.
That's correct. And in many ways, that's also a correct perception of the decade in the sense that the left, liberals, and progressives really had the handle on social change in that period. And yet it's precisely because of those kind of changes and the success of those changes that conservatives were also being galvanized and mobilizing in response to that. So sort of buffeted and buffered by progressive social change, conservatives began to organize and mobilize.
Why pick Orange County in particular?
Why pick Orange County?
Yeah.
Well, if you know something about the history of the county and you know something about conservatism in the 1960s, Orange County is a really logical place to study grassroots mobilization, because Orange County had a very strong and vibrant conservative movement that in that time period many kind of national media outlets remarked upon. And so in looking at conservatism nationally, Orange County kind of stands out as a very significant point to look at. And I think it also serves as a kind of prototype for broader changes that are going on. In other words, the movement there was more visible, but it's not unique. It represents broader kind of trends that are underway in other places that are happening less visibly, and Orange County brings them together in a stronger way.
But you point out that the media kind of distorted what was happening here. They had really weird names for Orange County, called them kooks and, you know, nuthouses, nutcases or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
That was a perception of, that was, in a sense, conservatives' position. It wasn't just Orange County that was labeled that way. Orange County was labeled kind of nut country precisely because of the strength of conservative sentiment there. But people, national conservatives that today are considered very much part of the respectable conservative mainstream and kind of a part of the national leadership, somebody like Bill Buckley was labeled by Newsweek the enfant terrible of the far right in the 60s. So there was a kind of the discourse around conservatism was very different.
I was impressed that you focused on a lot of individuals that were doing like normal stuff, like grassroots stuff in a way. But what was striking about it is a lot of the issues that were prevalent then, like sex education and stuff like that, is actually still going on over like the internet web access.
Mm-hmm.
There's school board controversies over gay groups on campus. So
right.
The conservative right is actually still mobilizing over the same issues.
Right. Well, the social issues, I mean, these are issues, I mean, sort of moral issues have always galvanized conservatives, but it's really in the 1960s, in particular the late 60s, as a counterculture, youth culture, new notions of sort of sexual liberation, the women's movement, and particularly in the early 70s, gay rights take off, that you get this kind of comes to the forefront of conservative mobilization. In the 60s, it kind of submerged under an anti-communist discourse. By the late 60s and 70s, you get this sort of center on social issues and on family values, and that's over precisely these issues of sex education, abortion, that are still very much mobilizing social conservatives today.
But you say that this movement led to the election of Ronald Reagan, but it also other people didn't get make a very successful run, like John Schmitz, who was a congressman from Orange County at the time, and he was a butcher.
That's right.
But later on, he ran for president, and he didn't get very far, right?
He didn't at all. He ran on the American Independent Party in the wake of the shooting of Wallace, and Wallace's abandonment of his campaign. He ran on an independent third-party ticket. He got very little support in Orange County. Partly, he wrote himself out of the mainstream of the conservative movement in Orange County by strongly criticizing Richard Nixon, who was a Republican Party candidate. And that was simply, for many kind of pragmatic Orange County conservatives, unacceptable, even though they were critical of some of Nixon's policies.
He was saying that he had sold out to the Russians or something.
Right.
And it turns out we have his papers here. Of the campaign, of the post-Congress stuff.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I looked through it the other day, and when he died, we actually went through and got it cataloged.
Uh-huh.
And he died recently, and there were letters from kids listening to him on the radio, calling him the super patriot.
Right.
These were teenagers in San Diego, for instance, sending him postcards supporting his presidential campaign.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I know his congressional papers are all out at
Oklahoma.
Kansas.
Wichita.
Yeah.
Right.
Were those papers were just recently deposited, I imagine?
No, it was deposited some in the 80s and 90s.
Oh,
and
that's interesting.
And we actually never cataloged it, but then when he just died, I think, right before he died, we actually started looking at it.
I think those would be really interesting papers to take a look at.
Yeah, there's a finding aid on the web, and actually I sent you the URL to that already.
Mm-hmm.
It's some of our finding aids are actually on the website.
Right.
So it lists the contents of each box. So there's actually a lot of kind of anti-Semitic and kind of paranoid stuff.
Right.
Literature that he, publications that he wrote in.
Right.
In your book, you point out that the Birchers actually were good organizers. They trained a lot of people in, you know, grassroots organizing, right?
Right. In some ways, they were and they weren't. I mean, it was a national organization driven from the top down, and in some ways, it's the grassroots conservatives themselves that infused real life into the organization. So you could say Birchers were good organizers. I'm not sure you could say the organization was a good model of spurring. It actually did succeed in some ways, but many people pointed out that they themselves who started out, as this is kind of their first place for conservative activism, people I spoke to said that their feeling was that the society itself wasn't doing enough. Letter writing for them wasn't enough. Sitting in people's living rooms and discussing, they really wanted to get out and do stuff and get active in politics. And the Birch Society, of course, did not consider itself as political as it was as an educational vehicle, directly political as a kind of mobilization for electoral party politics. And so, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, it did, in fact, mobilize many people at the grassroots. It got them together with other people. It served as a kind of networking organization. And some people have put it, one person I interviewed put it, as it served as a kind of boot camp.
Yeah.
And then conservatives kind of left it and didn't necessarily, just because they abandoned the society, they didn't necessarily abandon conservative politics or conservative organizing, but found different and in some ways more respectable channels to, you know, to mobilize in.
Did they leave because of the media depiction of the group?
Partly, some did, some never, you know, some people that were very involved in the conservative movement that embraced many of the beliefs of people, you know, that would have considered themselves sort of allies of the society, found that its reputation kept them from joining, and others also, yes, abandoned the society precisely because they found that it could not serve as a successful vehicle because it was so extremely marginalized, even though, you know, through the media, and that marginalization was... It was engendered by the society itself because Robert Welch made very, very off-the-wall statements, and at its radical edge, the Birch Society did embrace these conspiratorial theories. The people within the society itself, however, did not necessarily share those theories, but saw for a while the society as the only vehicle for channeling conservative activism. And once there were other vehicles, you know, when sort of Ronald Reagan was elected in 1966, when there was the other sort of more respectable ways when conservatives had a broader voice, they no longer needed the Birch Society as a vehicle, and members began to drop out and look toward other channels.
But wasn't the brand of the Birch's brand of anti-communism attractive to them?
It was for a while, and that's the thing. I mean, in the 1960s, it was quite, in the early 60s, it was quite successful because you still had this kind of discourse that came out of McCarthyism in the 50s and then survived well into the 60s. But by the late 60s, anti-communism is no longer the kind of galvanizing tool to mobilize people. It was just not as successful as an issue. It was post-Goldwater, there was a recognition, the Goldwater came in 64, that this was in a way of succeeding only to marginalize conservatives to focus so much on the issue of communism and Soviet takeover, or use the terms of socialism and communism to define opposition to the welfare state. And so it became a kind of marginalizing form. In fact, the Birch Society never succeeded in moving away from anti-communism and marginalized itself. In fact, the Register, in some article in the late 60s, picked up the Orange County Register on this, what was then,
Santa Ana Register.
It was the Santa Ana Register, then it became the Register, then it became the Orange County Register. But at that time, it's remarked, you know, that there's a new generation of conservatives that believe the same things, but is no longer in the forefront of their mind is this anti-communism. And I think that really is something which the Birch Society kept pushing it as an issue and marginalized itself as a result.
I was impressed that you point out that, I mean, there's people tend to demonize the right and think that people in the right are stupid. And but you point out that the people that's were active in these groups were actually highly educated. They were modern looking. I think
it's
argued...
very difficult if you think about it today. I mean, it's true that there was a sense of course, you know, the whole consensus school scholarship in that time period marginalize the right, I would say less by saying they're stupid, but by psychologizing them as kind of clinical cases. You know,
psychoanalyzing them.
Psychoanalyzing them, exactly. Now, if you do that today, you're going to be psychoanalyzing a great deal of the Bush administration and much of Congress. And, I mean, you know, it's just very conservative. You cannot simply kind of pigeonhole them as it's too simplistic to make an argument that they're kind of clinically off, because it's not historical, and it's not it doesn't succeed in taking the movement seriously, and we need to take the movement seriously. So
they basically organize around political issues. You would say
in Orange County in the 60s, or they mobilized. I'm sorry.
Yeah, in the 60s. I mean,
around social and political issues.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, concerns about liberals in the schools, about what they called communist penetration in the school system, which really meant liberal ideas about education, liberal ideas about nationhood, about schooling, about the welfare state, etc. It became political. But partly it's about social and cultural issues.
How come the ACLU seems as such a threat? You point to a case of ACLU inviting Frank Wilkerson to speak about the Red Squad investigations type stuff.
Right.
And legislative investigations of communism. And why was that becoming such a mobilizing force?
Well, I mean, in Wilkinson in particular, he was brought in by a local school board trustee, Joel Dorman, who was a Democratic Party activist and a member of the ACLU. And Wilkinson had been censored for, lost his job with the Los Angeles Housing Authority because of, you know, that he refused to answer questions right. in front of the House committee. And this is, the ACLU, of course, was very, was about First Amendment rights and free speech, and protested this kind of treatment of individuals in front of HUAC, et cetera, and eventually, you know, became part of this campaign to work to abolish HUAC. Southern California ACLU was quite quite liberal, and this became a target of attack of conservatives and the right because the ACLU was at the forefront of seeking to abolish what they saw as an ally, as a sort of patriotic organization, you know, in fighting, as they would put it, fighting subversives. And of course, you know, the ACLU obviously saw it as a kind of an unconstitutional body that was impinging on individuals' rights to free speech and to organization.
Yeah, in 1955, in July, you know, Disneyland was formed in Orange County. It was set up, and you say that was the perfect place for it. Why?
The perfect place for it. Well, I mean, I think I say, you know, it fits very well to this kind of mid-20th century utopia which Southern California was becoming. It was a kind of counterpoint to East Coast amusement parks like Coney Island that were seen as kind of you know, decrepit and with hostile employees, and Walt Disney himself was a Republican Party, big Republican Party supporter in California, who was very conservative, and developed a park with that was orientated around conservative kind of family values, and at the same time, it's this kind of very extremely modern park, and that's there's kind of this paradox of conservatism in California is that it's extremely modern and it's an extremely modern place, and people tend to think of conservatism as an anti-modernist ideology, and here the two go very much hand in hand.
So it's a mix of traditionalism, as you said,
and modernity,
exactly. You wrote.
Right.
how about this whole idea that the terminology, you know, like we talked a little bit about this, but you don't agree with calling most of these conservatives like extreme right wing or terms like that.
Ultra conservative, extreme.
Yeah.
Yes,
extremes.
Far right. I think that those, you know, having done a good deal of work studying, you know, the kind of spectrum of conservatism in Orange County, it goes across the spectrum. There were organizations like the Minutemen, which you might consider far-right, which are paramilitary organizations, but they were really quite marginal in terms of the whole of the conservative movement. Places that have such conservative ideology, that ideologies or that sort of swim in these kind of waters, I think also generate on the margins a far-right, and that existed in Southern California, but it doesn't define the heart and the mainstream of the movement. So I think it's a mistake to kind of write this off as ultra conservatism or far right. I don't think it's a proper characterization of the movement as a whole, which fits much more closely with, you know, the kind of conservatism that is now dominant at the national level.
You write that the deep roots of these of this movement need to be understood, and that it didn't happen sui generis. You know, it didn't happen by itself. It came from somewhere. So where did it come from?
Well, I mean, conservatism has a long history, and in fact, has prior to the New Deal, really, one could argue, was certainly a very kind of mainstream, if not dominant, idea at the national level. I mean, at that point, prior to the New Deal, libertarian ideals, somebody like Herbert Hoover and the whole Republican administration in the 20s, for example, very much embraced ideas that would fit extremely well with what became known as conservatism prior to post-New Deal. And so the label switched. In other words, a classical 19th century liberalism fits very well with what became known as conservatism. And then also, obviously, social conservatism and religious fundamentalism is something which is generated much earlier than the 1960s and came around in the 1910s and 1920s, where you get the first kind of mobilizations of the fundamentalist movement and a kind of conservative turn in evangelical circles. And in fact, of course, actually out of California, that the fundamentals, which is the main sort of early bulletins of that movement, come from. Where they're printed out of.
Did you talk to Tom Rogers also?
I did talk to Tom Rogers. Yes, I did. I had an interview with Tom Rogers some time ago now, a couple of years perhaps, or a year or two.
He's come up with his own book.
He had told me that he was writing a book at that time.
It's basically like profiles of people in Orange County that were politically active. It's like hundreds of pages.
Right.
And, it's actually left and right. He focuses on, he's kind of actually, you know, eclectic about it. And he puts in a lot of people who are liberals also.
Somebody like Larry Agron or something.
Yeah. And he even says nice words about OC Weekly, which I write for, which is an alternative paper now out in Orange County. And so.
Interesting.
But how did you find him?
I found him, let me think about how, he was a good person to speak to because he had been chair of the Orange County Republican Central Committee in the 1960s, and I think that's how his name first came to me, and then it became quite clear that he was extremely involved in kind of grassroots organizing, first around the John Schmitz campaign in 1964.
Right. He was a finance manager.
Chair. And then he also wrote for The Wanderer, which is a Catholic traditionalist paper. So right. I found out that he was actually quite immersed in all these different circles, also national circles of conservatism, and he was really a very good person to speak to. But so you start out with just one idea about, you know, and you learn much more, obviously, once you start to interview people.
Did you, coming from, you know, East Coast, was it hard for you to gain access to some of these circles?
You know, people I have to say, not really. I mean, there were some people, perhaps, I mean, once I talked to people, there were some people that did not want to be interviewed. Some people that whose names I had, who I would call up on the telephone, I didn't know anything about them except that they were part of this mobilization, that they were grassroots, who would say, you know, that they preferred not to be interviewed. So in that sense, you could say they were skeptical or that they were put off for whatever reason. I mean, I'm not sure if it was coming from the East Coast or if it was simply not wanting to do this kind of interviewing. But for the most part, I actually encountered a very receptive audience, and I think that people wanted to, you know, I mean, they were initially skeptical in the sense of saying, why are you interested in doing this? And we're often quite satisfied with this very simple answer of saying, well, look, you know, this is a gap in the historical record. This is a mobilization that has had a national impact that hasn't been written about in a serious analytical way, and that's my intention. And that was often enough for people. People were very open in talking about their history and their involvement. Now, you have to remember that for people that were part of this mobilization, it's something that they're often quite proud of having been a part of.
Yeah.
And at the time, when they saw that, you know, all their work seemed to be, you know, marginalized and made fun of in the media, you know, this is in the 60s, by 1980, seeing Reagan elected, finally feeling understood, and then feeling like yet their sort of contribution to this has kind of gone by the wayside. So for them, it was sort of a retrieval, I think. I did not meet a lot of the skepticism one might expect to encounter from somebody from coming from first Columbia University and then Harvard. I think, though, that people were a little bit, you know, Harvard, East Coast, it's like the bastion of liberalism. there was that sense, but it sort of once you just, I think, saying that simple statement of I'm a historian and this is why I'm doing this work, people still might have been skeptical, but often still willing to, do an interview.
Did they question your own politics or your own interests?
You know, no one ever really directly, except for one individual, a very sort of prominent ex-congressperson, did ask me directly about my own politics. Hmm. If somebody didn't ask me directly, then I wasn't, you know, I didn't feel that it was, you know, relevant. I didn't want to make it relevant. I'm a historian, and that's sort of where I was coming from in writing this, and that's what I wanted to accentuate. But if somebody asked me directly, you know, are you a member of a political party, I answered, and and I'm a member of the Democratic Party, and that, you know, that was the only time actually that one person really directly asked me about that.
Was that Dannemeyer?
That was, yes. And he still was willing to speak to me, but I guess, you know, part of it, you know, me arguing, of course, that, you know, you don't have to be of a movement to write about a movement,
right,
and take it seriously.
Right.
And that's always been my point, and I think that's an important point.
Yeah, because I think the problem with the left, I think, is that we kind of ignore the right,
mm-hmm,
in a sense, except that when, you know, controversies happen, but nobody really wants to study them.
Right.
I remember talking with Rebecca Klatch.
Uh-huh.
She was on the show before.
Right.
And she's interviewed conservative women.
Right.
And she also tries to present the fact that these are normal people that get involved politically.
Right.
And so I think the left kind of is at its own peril when it doesn't try to research,
right,
its opposition.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's important. This is an important historical force. Conservatives have a very long history. These traditions are part of our political culture. You know, it's incredibly important to understand them in a very serious way and not to simply try and write them off as if that's going to help them to go away, you know?
It's kind of fantasy thinking. Yeah. How about Fred Schwartz? You spent some time writing about him and his crusades in Orange County. What was that about?
In fact, I interviewed him as well, although he now took off to Australia, I think, and retired. But, Fred Schwartz was organized the Schools of Anti-Communism and was part of the head of what was called the Christian Anti-Communism Crusade, which was an organization that essentially went around the country giving lectures and organizing these kind of schools to, quote-unquote, educate people about communism. He himself was a conservative, a religious, you know, conservative. His own beliefs were fundamentalist, but the fundamentalist edge of his politics were not, or his beliefs were not something that really came out as much as a kind of broader sort of conservatism. I mean, he tried to leave that out to gain a broader audience. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, he mobilized these schools of anti-communism in the Southwest and in places like Southern California. And in Orange County, the School of Anti-Communism that was organized there, Fred Schwartz was brought in by a group of grassroots individuals. And through that whole network of people that developed around the school, the mobilization really took off. People got to know each other. The school itself generated more conservative sentiment and more sentiment for mobilizing because Fred Schwartz really made an argument that it's very important for each individual to take a stance and get involved in mobilizing against, again, this kind of broad rubric of what was called communism, which was really much more about liberalism, and it was also about communism, but also about liberalism, the welfare state, and cultural change in the 1960s.
In chapter two, you say that at North La Palma Park,
right,
Stadium in Anaheim, there was actually 7,000 young people that,
right,
attended this Fred Schwartz School of Anti-Communism.
That's right. There were about, you know, 7,000 or so people that came out. Some of the individuals were released. This was in a school day. It was called Youth Day. The youths, Youth Day School of Anti-Communism. It was part of this whole series of 5 days of school running. And there's one focus on this, what was called Youth Day. And some school boards did release their students to be able to attend the program.
So it was endorsed by the schools?
Not by all the schools, but by a sufficient number of schools to get that number, many young people to come out into the stadium.
Mm-hmm. Wow. What are you going to do with all those auto history tapes you have? Are you going to deposit it in a collection?
Yes, I am going to deposit it. One of the many things that I have to organize and get rid of in terms of, that I don't want to get rid of, but sort of get out of the office and into an archive. And I think that it will be going to Cal State University Fullerton.
The Freedom Collection.
Freedom Center. Because the Freedom Center is not an oral history collection.
It's not really.
But there's the oral history program, and they do a lot of regional history.
Right.
And there's some people that didn't agree to that. I mean, there were a few people that felt actually, they didn't want to have their tapes deposited. But most people don't mind at all, and so those tapes will be deposited at Cal State Fullerton for future use for scholars.
Oh, that's great, yeah. Because I've been writing some stuff about anti-communist movement in Little Saigon more recently.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I write for the OC Weekly, and I cover there was this video store protest. And, a few years ago, there was a guy who put up a picture.
That's right, I remember that very well,
And then, but before that, there was other stuff. And, one of the more recent things I wrote was, a few years ago, actually, was about a Japanese, a white woman who was against reparations for Japanese Americans.
Uh-huh.
And she argued that, that the camps, the internment camps were actually to protect them, and that they were guests of the government, and they were there voluntarily.
Uh-huh.
And the barbed wire was to keep out the cattle, not to keep the people in.
Oh, God.
As if there were cattle in the desert.
Right.
So when she died, politician kind of person, he succeeded her, but they raised a lot of money because the LA Times wrote a laudatory obituary of her, saying that she was fighting for her beliefs, basically without criticizing us.
Right.
Usually obituaries say nice things, so they just said nice things and said she believed that these people were guests of the government and other stuff, apparently. Things like that.
Yeah.
And then they actually put a phone address so people could send checks to correct the historical record about Japanese internment.
Right.
So a lot of people sent checks, and they were supposed to win scholarships too. go to school to correct. So there's some, but that was a kind of a minor, although she did show up a lot, I guess, at the internment hearings.
Yeah.
Yeah, that were going on earlier, yeah.
And your work on Little Saigon, in terms of anti-communist stuff there now, is that what you're doing? Or?
Yeah, right, last 10, 20 years. I'm trying to focus more on the earlier years when there was a lot more hatred and a lot more murders, but a lot more violence.
And what are you writing a dissertation, or what are you doing?
No, I'm a librarian, and so I'm a political science bibliographer.
Yeah.
And I collect this type of stuff also for the library. We actually have a political literature collection that I've been collecting, actually right-wing and conservative pamphlets.
Right.
As well as left-wing. And so that's a thing that I've been doing the last few years. So for special
good.
Collections, actually. It's for
but
special
the
collections.
But stuff on the anti-communism in Orange County Little Saigon, that's fascinating. I mean, I think that's really important stuff to work on.
Yeah, I think the problem is that not that many people are writing about that period. And I even found out, there was a left-wing Vietnamese publication in Fullerton that was against the Vietnam War that Vietnamese students put out against the war. So there was a kind of a strain of students from Vietnam who were against the war in the 60s, and they even published newsletters and stuff.
Interesting.
In the 60s, and so there's a lot of stuff that could be dug up.
Right.
But I really am fascinated with your book that, the footnotes are already like 100, pages or whatever.
Right.
It's really, really, it's the most detailed work I've seen on that period.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. And also the footnotes, a lot of the people I know, that I've known of are still active
Right.
especially liberals, who you quote a few liberals,
Yeah.
they're still active, some of them, and some professors you quote from UCI,
Right, right.
wrote written books and stuff, about the period.
Right.
Yeah. So, are you giving up on this topic or?
Well, not, I wouldn't say giving up. I mean, one's interests are always spur new ideas, and I think somebody should write a kind of sequel book, actually, to this, and actually the kind of anti-communist sentiment or the broadening spectrum of the
Yeah.
ethnic rainbow in Orange County, I think it would be really interesting after 1980. I would love to see kind of follow-up book
Yeah.
on what happened to conservative politics post-1980 in Orange County, but I'm not going to write it. I mean, I'm on to
Yeah.
a different topic. I'm going to be working on a book on prohibition in the 1920s.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Which it involves obviously religious the sort of formation of the religious right. This is when the religious right really takes off and gets involved in social issues and gets involved in prohibition enforcement. The Ku Klux Klan is very deeply involved in prohibition
Yeah,
enforcement,
yeah.
but it's much broader than that because obviously a whole group of progressives also supported initially prohibition. So it's a fascinating topic, and I'm just starting to get into it. So.
Would you call yourself a liberal also?
Yes, I would
Yeah.
call myself liberal. Yes, I would. I was always for a very long time averse to answering the questions about defining my politics in terms of the book because in researching in particular, I didn't want people to pigeonhole me and say, okay, we're not going to talk to this person. Now I obviously don't have to worry about that, but it's still, and that's a set of politics. I'm, in terms of this book, I think of myself first and foremost as a historian,
Sure,
obviously,
sure,
so.
sure, sure. Yeah, I think the sequel is interesting because the Republicans actually capitalized on the refugee crisis, but then actually Loretta Sanchez has done the same. She marched in. I wrote about this in OC Weekly. She marched around Little Saigon waving the South Vietnamese flag, a flag that doesn't, a country that doesn't exist,
Right.
anti-communists with the other anti-communists.
Right.
And she's a Democrat from
Right.
Orange County, so I think the Democrats have been able to parlay that into votes.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to focus.
Yeah, I think it would be great to do some kind of article or piece on that. The in-migration and the politics of that and the way it shifted over generations. I mean, I just think it's fascinating,
Because
so.
for years the Democrats ignored Little Saigon, didn't even have office
Right.
there to recruit, but then the demographics changed. A lot more Latinos also came in,